podcast edit by Abe's Audio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are listening to this episode from. Welcome to Mumbrella's one-on-one podcast series. I'm your host and the editor of Mumbrella, Neil Griffiths. Before we get into the episode, as always, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast wherever you're listening to this from. And check out mumbrella.com.au for everything happening in the media and marketing world. With just 4 weeks to go until Mumbrella 360 2024, I am rapt to be joined by one of the keynote speakers today. He made sure to make sure that it was a keynote. It is Tim Ross. Now, many will know Tim as one half of Merrick and Rosso, the famous radio duo from the 2000s. Tim has gone on to do so many more things. Obviously, he still works as a comedian, but he's a TV presenter. He's into architecture. He's into cars. He just released a book earlier this year called Chucka Yui, all about some of his favorite Australian vehicles. And as I mentioned, he'll be appearing at next month's Mumbrella 360 conference as a keynote speaker. He'll be delivering the session, Design Nerd Tim Ross's Six Red Hot Marketing Ideas from the 80s. So as well as delving into some of these ideas, don't worry, we don't give the six away. We talked a lot about his time in radio, obviously working with Merrick Watts throughout the 90s and 2000s, his run-ins with fame and success. Did he like it? Did he hate it? And him veering away from radio. Again, he's done so much more in the media world, on TV and on stage. It was a really fascinating chat with someone that personally I grew up listening to on the radio. So before we get into the episode, if you do want to see Tim at this year's Mumbrella 360, be sure to get your tickets now at mumbrella.com.au/Mumbrella360. So let's get into it. Here's my chat with Tim Ross on the one-on-one podcast. Tim, thanks so much for coming on, man.
It's a pleasure. Am I allowed to say that I'm doing a keynote?
Yes, you are. How does that feel?
Oh, good. Feels good.
Are you gonna...
It feels like I'm a retired cabinet member of the Liberal government, because that's it. I saw she's on the playlist. It's good. It's nice to be asked to come up and get on stage. I'm looking forward to it. So thank you for having me, and thank you for having me on.
Can we expect a tweed jacket and or a turtleneck during your keynote?
I haven't worked on my outfit yet, but anything could happen. Anything could happen. I'll wear something fancy. It'll be high fashion.
Well, you were speaking to Adam Lang, Mumbrella publisher there, and I missed the conversation because he was in the headphones. Where are you right now? It sounds and looks beautiful.
I'm on the northern rivers of New South Wales, glorious New South Wales. It's school holidays, so my kids aren't here at the moment, which is good. So I'm just taking a little break to chat to you. But I've been doing some painting.
Oh, very nice.
It's one of my skills, actually. I can paint a house when I need to. I prefer not to do it all the time, but I had a glorious family friend called Ted, who sadly passed away last year.
Sorry to hear.
But he taught me how to paint in my early 20s, and it was a great skill. I can cut in quite well. So when push comes to shove and I have to get on the brushes, I can get on the brushes, and I was up at 5 doing the first coat, and I've just finished the second coat, job done.
That's pretty great. Can you draw as well? Because my dad's a painter and has been for 40 years, and this, you know, unheard of skill. He can also trace really, really well, and he attributes it to being a painter, but I don't know if that's just garbage.
No, I can't. Well, I can draw, but not well. I'd like to be far more artistic than I am in that department. But if I was going to have a third act, being a ceramicist or being a painter would be a delightful one for me, I think.
Well, there's still time, my friend. That's the good news.
There is times, and the third acts have a way of being forced on you, not chosen. So if it all falls over, you'll see me in the shed knocking out ceramic panels and selling them at the market. Well, here on the northern rivers.
Well, here's hoping. I was going to say, it's been, you know, we're recording this mid to late April. It's already been a pretty crazy year for you. You obviously had the Chucka Yui book released earlier this year. You've got some shows, correct me if I'm wrong, you've already kicked off those live shows ahead of Mumbrella 360 next month. Busy 2024 so far, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of constantly on tour. I love this idea that I saw Paul Dempsey from the band Something for Kate sort of said something, said, "Oh, you're on tour." And he said, "Well, actually, you know, I'm always on tour. And, you know, like, I'm not Taylor Swift. It's not like, you know, you're in Melbourne for one night only." Yeah, so it's one of the joys of being able to perform live is that if you want to keep gigging, you just put on a show, put on another show. Sometimes the opportunity arises to go somewhere interesting and do something. So, yeah, I mean, at the basis of what I do most of the time is actually work live. There's a lot of other things that I do in terms of, you know, it's a real broad range of things from obviously documentaries, podcasts. I've always got at least one book on the go.
Is there a particular hat you like to wear? Because, you know, you mentioned right there, if we look at any Tim Ross press release, it's comedian, it's architecture nerd, a radio presenter. You're doing a keynote. You've done exhibitions. Is there one that you feel fits the best right now? Because I got to imagine this upcoming keynote at 360 won't just be you giving hot marketing tips without a joke that lands at all.
I think, look, I don't do comedy in a traditional sense anymore. In some people would say it, but there's always jokes. Sometimes there's not enough of them. They quite often, when I'm making the docos for the ABC, I think every single one of my directors actually told me to sort of insert more funny, because I can get a bit dry and boring and a bit obsessive about some of those architecture subjects. But the architecture and design tends to be my sweet spot. But the reality of that is it's actually probably more social history that I play in at the most. And that's where the Chucky Yui, the history of cars. I did a podcast for Nine about, you know, the cars that made Australia, and my documentaries fall into that place as well. And most of my projects have some sort of sense of, you know, Australian history or Australian culture, and sort of unpacking all sorts of things that interest me and tell us about who we are and who we could be.
Is that an intentional move on your part, or is that purely just how your career has progressed? Because, you know, as I'm 33 years old, so I grew up listening to you on the radio. You were one of Australia's most notable comedians, but as you said, that you don't joke around as much as you do as much as you're meant to, quote unquote. But
yeah,
do you mean to do that, or is that just, you know, you're more interested in the social history stuff and that's kind of just taken a back seat naturally?
Well, now this is the point where everyone goes, yeah, traditionally people do get old and boring, particularly comedians. I think it's really about passion. So, like, I like storytelling, and with that always comes comedy. But I don't like, say, the constraints of what being a stand-up comedian is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite comfortable with doing live shows that have, you know, large sections of them that maybe don't have too many funnies in it. So, it's a running my own race type situation. Did I choose it? My interest in architecture and design has been around since I was as a kid, really. I can trace it back to that. And certainly it's always been sitting there in parallel. And I think certainly the opportunity came to do things that I think for me are just a little bit more interesting and just it's not the evolution of doing the same thing. And it's pretty much in parallel with the way most people's lives are these days. You'll have a million different careers. We're going to live and work, you know, much longer than our parents and grandparents did. And as we see jobs sort of extinguishing, so like you talk about the radio, the sort of role and the significance of a role like doing a breakfast show that I was doing with Mez in the early 2000s, you know, they just don't have the same resonance anymore. There's people listening to all sorts of things. My kids have no real connection with radio. They listen to music and podcasts in the car on the way to school. So, you have to keep evolving. And I think that's the really interesting thing about it is that your ability to reach audiences in different ways and, more importantly, to fragment and to be able to do things that are niche and make a living out of that is extraordinary in this moment in time, and it's only going to get more and more interesting, I think, and I hope, for people who feel like, yeah, like I'm really into, you know, being a professional cyclist, or I really like mountain biking, and I'd really like to start a mountain biking podcast, and I might do some sort of Instagram page that does that, and then, wow, before I know it, I'm going all around the world, and I'm meeting all my heroes, and I'm doing a podcast about it. That's really something that, you know, if that's your jam, if you want to, you can make that happen pretty simply.
Mm. It's funny you mentioned, you mentioned that, you know, it's not the same connection as it is or it was back then. And it's funny because one of my biggest American and Rosso memories was actually, and it's such a morbid story, but obviously I grew up on you guys, very funny show. But one of the biggest memories that sticks out was the morning of September 11th. And I woke up and you guys were both being incredibly unfunny because it was this moment in time that was so monumental and it sticks with you. Whereas, you know, if that happened today, I look on Google, I look on TikTok, I have Instagram. Yeah. I find that stuff out much quicker than you do engaging with those morning shows. Is that one of the reasons you kind of, maybe not intentionally, but stepped away from radio just because there wasn't that connection that you enjoyed?
No, I mean, I think that was an interesting moment in time, clearly, and a really challenging one as a broadcaster to sort of have to, you know, put the jokes aside for 3 hours.
Sure.
And it wasn't in the family, it was for a week, really, and to walk into work and see that footage like everyone else did. And it is, you're not the first person to have mentioned to that, to both Merrick and I over the years for that reason. And I think it was because it was a very different side to who we were on the radio. I think it's more choosing to do what I do is really what interests me the most, and I'm sort of driven by not having a job per se and being able to do a whole bunch of different things. And so if I want to do something with my kids, or I want to go overseas and do something, or I want to take on a different project, I have that flexibility. And I think that's probably what drives what I'm doing now, is that I don't want to be in the radio studio every day between 6 and 9 or whatever, and then go into a meeting and then come home and be tired, or whether or not I'm tired or not, it's really not really the issue, but just to meet different people in a different environment. I think I'd be insane if I was still doing that. I admire those that do, but you know, it's not for me.
Did you enjoy the vain side of being one of Australia's, if not the most popular radio duo? You know, the fame you get with that, you're interviewing biggest musicians and actors in the world. Did you ever give a shit about that kind of stuff? Or was that kind of just it's part of the job? And as you said before, what you really love is getting to interview and sit down with your heroes.
I think it was really great to meet a whole bunch of really interesting people at different times, and people who grew up and watching on the telly, and just surprising ones, like people like Tim Brooke Taylor from The Goodies, which was just for me was like incredible. Sure. David Attenborough is similar. And interviewing a bunch of people before the rise of the internet, and they were probably a little bit more candid when they came out to Australia in those days. I certainly remember a very candid Jodie Foster in a way that you probably wouldn't see today, and she was incredibly charming and really honest about a whole bunch of things. We had a great time, and we were incredibly lucky, and we were in the right place at the right time, and there was we had a genuine chemistry, and we generally enjoyed playing together, you know, and we learnt that skill on stage, and so we just really just transferred that onto the microphone, and we made it up as we went along, and we were pretty protective of our brand and what we did, I think, and so that sort of probably was one of the reasons we had a pretty good run. But you know, we just loved it. We just had a great time. It was just fun.
But there's been story, particularly in the last week, stories that, you know, there's this quote unquote grudge between you and Merrick. But talking to you now, it kind of just feels like it's not a personal thing. It's just you're not invested in being a full-time radio star anymore. Is it as simple as that?
Yeah, I think Merrick and I, the way I describe it, we're like brothers, you know. We have a, you know, no one else understands what happened at that time. There's a few people we worked with that we're very close to that were in the trenches with us. But, you know, we have so much shared memories. We have beautiful in-jokes that no one else gets. And so that's our, like, twins and some sort of ridiculous fucking, you know, secret language. We have that. And we always share stories about when people come up and tell us about something, the particularly surprising moments that when people were listening to something or they saw something or, you know, when they saw us somewhere. And that's like amazing when someone says, oh, we saw you at the Enmore and we saw you at the bloody Cronulla RSL, or I was a kid and I listened to you on the radio. Oh, we couldn't have done that without people listening to us. So yeah, I think what really unites us in our friendship is that shared history, and you know, and we're really, really lucky to have that bond.
What if someone offered you Carl and Jackie O money to come back?
Not a chance. No, I'm good.
Wow.
I mean, I think it's in the past.
Yeah.
You know, ask me if it was real.
Sure. Well, it's funny. Jules Lund was at the retail summit last month, and I got to catch up with him. And you guys are similar in the way that you had this incredibly successful radio career, but you've just found these other passions. You know, Jules is killing it with Tribe Marketing.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you do see people in whatever industry it may be, they're trying to keep that flame alive, whereas you and Jules just seem to go, you know, I'm over here now. I'm doing this, and I love this.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people like that. And I always thought with radio that you meet everyone but know no one. So you can rattle off a whole bunch of people that you met and you spent 7 minutes with them in a hotel room or something like that. And then when I finished up Breakfast for the first time and I suddenly started to live my life in a completely different way, you know, I have moments of being a pretty severe workaholic. So, and that was certainly the case with my time in Breakfast Radio. You know, we weren't just making those live shows, but a lot of TV shows. And so I just wanted to go out and meet new people and have new experiences and new friendships outside of what I was doing and be able to make connections, especially within my sphere of interest in architecture and design all over the world. And so, you know, I'm going to London in a few weeks for the Festival of Architecture to do some shows, and I will hook in with a whole bunch of people that love what I love, and we know the other people all over the world, and we'll chat about stuff, and, you know, I just have a glorious time doing that. It is that, you know, slightly rubbishy find your tribe concept. I sort of did. So that's where the magic sits for me.
Tell me if this story is complete rubbish, because right before we jumped on, Adam was here as well, and he said the reason that he jumped at the opportunity to try and get you on board with 360 was because he was listening to a previous episode of this podcast with Greg Hoffman, the former Nike CMO, and Greg mentioned that when he gets to Sydney, he really wants to immerse himself in the architecture here, and Adam immediately thought of you, and he wants to get you two connected. Did he tell you that story?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
And I always thought, I thought that's one of my great joys.
Yeah.
If someone comes from overseas and wants to get in the car and go around and have a look at things or have a chat about stuff, I'm bang up for it. And I think we've sort of forgotten in some ways to show people around. And when I went to New Zealand, to Wellington, this friend of mine picked me up from the airport at midnight. No one picks anyone up from the airport anymore. And he just showed me around. And I was doing a talk for them, but he said, oh, we're just going to do this. I've got this organized at this house and we're going to have a little bit of quiche in this place. It was fantastic. And I gained a lot from that. And I think sometimes we think we're too busy or when I was a kid, when people came from overseas, it was a big deal, and we would go out of our way to show them hospitality. And I think since globalization, we've sort of, we don't find the magic in that. We've sort of, in order to feel a little bit superior about ourselves and not feel like we're sort of country bumpkins, we've forgotten that it's okay to be a small place that's big on hospitality. I think we lack some warmth sometimes as a nation.
That's a good segue into your session at 360, which is called Design Nerd Tim Ross's 6 Red Hot Marketing Ideas from the 80s. Obviously, your car book as well was kind of looking at the yesteryear. Now, nostalgia is a thing that picked up a lot during the COVID pandemic. Have you always felt this way, that we've done things better, or is just recently where you're like, the way we do things now sucks? Let's go back to the 80s or 90s, whatever it may be.
I think we forget how good we are at a lot of things. And I think if you do look in the past, and I suppose this is there's certainly a certain in terms of architecture and design in my series that I've made for the ABC, there is a lot of looking back to say, oh, we used to be really good at this, but now we don't do it so well. And trying to unpack why we've gone backwards in some ways. And over time, we forget that we're super inventive. We forget that we can punch above our weight in things that go beyond sport, I suppose. And cars are a great example of that. No, it doesn't make sense for us to make cars here anymore. But it's important for us to look back at what that meant to us when we could. The idea of the Ford versus Holden rivalry that was schoolyard stuff. It was workplaces. It was pubs. It was totally boganic, but it was ours and it meant something to us. No one's getting, Kia versus Hyundai in the playground anymore. We've moved on and that was simpler times and I get all that. But there's something in that sort of national ideal that what sort of nation can't design, engineer and manufacture its own things.
Sure.
And I think if you grew up like I did, and it's pretty common for Gen Xers to grow up in the sort of the shadow of the optimism of say the Opera House at this sort of pivotal moment, 1973, that somehow there was a rise in Australian culture and a rise in the optimism of the 1980s, I think, shaped a lot of us. The America's Cup, World Series cricket, the Australians taking on the world in all sorts of ways, whether it was music with NXS or whether it was Paul Hogan with Crocodile Dundee, there was a sense that we could do anything. We still feel that we can do that. But I think some of the optimism has disappeared, and I suppose that's probably what I'll be tapping into in my keynote session.
No, I don't want to
give too much away, apart from the fact that it's probably Mentos on the tables.
Well, is there actually?
This should be a Mentos. I haven't worked any sort of corporate gig where there hasn't been Mentos on the table.
Well, this is what I was going to ask is, I don't want to ask what are the 6 tips, because that ruins your session. Yeah. But is there a general theme here? Is it, you alluded to some examples there with sport and film. Is it a particular industry that you think is that could really use those tips from back in the 80s?
I think it's the idea of surprising people. And one of the things I'm going to talk about, I'm happy to chat about this because, plenty of people won't come. I remember hosting Mumbrella 360 about 12 years ago. I did a couple of years of it, I think. Mm-hmm. And how many of my colleagues, they used to share the same passes. Like, they'd buy one for the workplace, and these are big companies.
Yeah.
And they'd be swapping laminates at the front of the convention center. Now, what are you doing? I said, we only bought 2, what, for the whole office? And then some of you got to wait in the car and then come back.
That's a new low.
You wanted to. Anyway. I was talking about Paul Hogan, and I obviously the shrimp on a Barbie campaign was the one that we all think about in terms of the success of Paul Hogan. But the one I like to talk about is a campaign that he did before that, which was probably in some ways more successful and certainly more sinister, and sort of and shows the power of a huge personality to sell something that's not grouse.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of Paul Hogan launching the Winfield cigarette brand is extraordinary as a case study. You know, within a year, that's the highest brand new cigarette is the highest selling cigarette in the country. The Americans had to send from Marlboro, sending people out to work out what exactly had happened in Australia. And we take, not, people don't smoke so much anymore, but the concept of Winnie Reds or Winnie Blues is so deeply embedded. Any owl have a Winfield, so deeply embedded in our culture. You know, Hoag's power as a personality to launch a brand so successfully, using on the TV, on ads, telling us that smokes are great for us, and using his theme from his TV show. I mean, it's from another planet now to look back at it. But extraordinary story to think that, you know, you can launch a product out of the blue in one market with a brand new brand, and his power was enough to see it through for years, that it became, you know, a sadly iconic brand in this country.
Mm. Now, this is an ignorant question because I was born in 1990, but did all of Paul Hogan's massive campaigns, was this all post Dundee success?
No, so that one was before.
Wow, okay.
So by the time, I can't remember what time they, by the early to mid 80s, I think they'd stopped doing commercials on TV for cigarettes. Maybe it was the late 70s, early 80s.
Yep.
And so it was sometime in the mid 1970s that he launched Winfield. And then, so what they did after that was, when they weren't allowed to do ads on the commercials, on commercial TV, that's a, brands like Benson and Hedges went deeply into sport. And so the cricket was sponsored by Benson Hedges, so you could get around it in that way.
Right. I mean,
you know, those companies have been really, really good at just finding workarounds. Even in more recently, British American Tobacco, you know, had a pretty heavy involvement with the Big Day Out with their smoking tents. You know, so you basically go into a tent and have a dart, and there was lots of money being exchanged there. So if they talk about the woes of Australian festivals, maybe taking some cancer money from the cigarette companies on the sly might be the saviour.
Maybe add that to your keynote.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate your time. I know you're in a very beautiful area right now, so yeah, I've taken, mate, up some of your day.
Mate, it's been a pleasure, Neil, and thank you for listening. How old were you when you were listening to me on the radio?
I would have been. When did you guys wrap up Nova?
2008 or something, nine.
So I'm 1990, so I would have, like, my heyday was in like between 10 and 15.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It was good to have you along for the ride, buddy.
Yeah, man, definitely. And it'll be good to have you at 360 next month, and we'll chat there.
Mate, yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
That's our episode. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you again to Tim Ross for coming on this week's show. Again, if you want to see Tim on stage doing his thing, be sure to get your tickets for Mumbrella 360 at mumbrella.com.au/Mumbrella360. There's 4 weeks to go, so get moving. That's it from me this week. I'll talk to you again next Wednesday for the Mumbrella Cast. We'll see you then.
Podcast edit by Abe's Audio.